whoever is going to be in charge just needs to lead us and be nice and smart and democratic.
Perhaps the most pivotal U.S. presidential election event is about to happen. It's Tuesday, September 29th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Follow us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, presidential debate moments, possible election spoiler alert, protecting social media, going to college at home, and saving food. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The first U.S. presidential election debate between Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden will set the tone for the final push to the November 3rd election. Which candidate will appeal the most to voters after being seen in a face-to-face debate? The encounter in Cleveland, Ohio is the first of three scheduled debates. The election campaign is close, both nationally and in Ohio, a swing state, where voters' opinions about the two candidates differ sharply from one household to the next. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti is in Cleveland for the debate.
This Trump flag was the first sign of politics in this Ohio neighborhood.
I debated whether to put it up or not because I was afraid my house might get shot at. And then I thought, you know what? I'm not living in fear.
But then, across the street, a Biden supporter, a friend of 44 years.
Whoever is going to be in charge just needs to lead us and be nice and smart and democratic.
Yeah, I hope the best man wins.
I didn't think they were going
to. Oh, he will.
Ohio is a crucial state. No Republican has ever won the presidency without winning Ohio. President Trump won the state by 8 points in 2016. But this year, polls show only a few points separating him from Democratic challenger Joe Biden, as neighbors and sometimes families split their allegiance.
Half of my kids are Trump supporters, so we don't invite them over anymore. No, they can't come over until next year. So, you know what I mean? So we say we aren't going to talk about politics, even though we do, and then we stop it.
Across the country, polarization of Trump and Biden supporters can deeply affect families. Case Western Reserve's Joe White teaches American politics and the presidency.
Republicans are more upset about the possibility of their child marrying a person of the same gender or who is transgender. Democrats are much more upset about the idea of their child marrying a Republican.
I'm going to get a wheel put riding with Biden, too. I think I'm going to decorate the whole front lawn.
No, how about hiding with Biden?
Dolores Gentile says her friendship with Patty Lucci rises above politics.
I like Trump. They like Biden. So what? One of them's going to win.
The first presidential debate Tuesday at Case Western Reserve University, not far from their houses, is expected to be contentious.
Vice President Biden will presumably be trying to walk a fine line of some sort. But he also wants to find ways to make Trump look as bad as possible, which may mean baiting him.
The debate venue in Cleveland awaits the two men to discuss their records, the Supreme Court, the coronavirus pandemic, election security, and the economy. Another topic, racial justice protests that have at times triggered rioting and looting.
That's why I'm voting for President Trump, because it seems like the Democratic Party has not condemned any of this.
I just think Trump says, I think he's mean. That's what I think upsets me. I think he says really mean things.
A new poll shows that 2 out of 3 Ohioans say that politics has strained their relationship with family and friends. They say they cope by avoiding any election talk. Instead, they'll leave the real debating up to the two candidates here at this pavilion on Tuesday. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Cleveland, Ohio.
These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. India tops 6 million COVID-19 cases. Australia gradually eases its toughest COVID-19 lockdown in Melbourne. Sri Lanka returns hazardous waste to Britain. South Korean president expresses regret over killing of official by North Korean troops. 3 Bollywood stars questioned in drug investigation. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Avoiding any major mistakes is a principal goal for President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden in their first debate. VOA's Steve Reddish looks at some of those historic debate moments that shaped U.S. politics.
The candidates need no introduction. The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy.
From Kennedy versus Nixon to Clinton versus Trump, presidential debates have generated special, sometimes career-defining moments, leaving an indelible mark on American politics.
Almost always, every debate cycle I can remember, something happened in one of those debates that, despite the candidate, showed American people something that they needed to know about the candidate.
For Walter Mondale, it happened twice when he challenged President Ronald Reagan seeking his second term.
Reagan wasn't really following his script very well. And he'd get into these speeches and he'd get lost in the middle of it. He'd forget where he's going.
The two-thirds of the defense budget pays for pay and salary, or pay and pension. And then you add to that food and wardrobe and all the other things, and you only have a small portion going for weapons.
We don't get too many opportunities to see the candidates unfiltered and side by side and on live television without the mediation of journalists or without the handlers right there affecting how and what they say.
Alan Schroeder is a journalism professor at Northeastern University. He wrote a book on TV's role in presidential debates, starting with the first one in 1960 between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon.
Nixon, having just been released a few weeks earlier from the hospital, had lost a lot of weight, was very pallid, didn't really put on the makeup that he should have had put on, and was sweating and was underweight and just didn't look well on camera.
As we know, Nixon refused to have any makeup. And so he looked like he had a shadow. For those who listened on the radio, they thought Nixon won. For those who watched TV, they thought, Kennedy won.
Frank Sesno is director of strategic initiatives at George Washington University and covered the White House for CNN.
You know, there was the famous moment way back when Gerald Ford was running, where he tried to suggest that Poland was not part of the Soviet Empire.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
If you go back and look, the moderator is almost sort of speechless.
Mary Kate Carey teaches political science and is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia Miller Center. She was a speechwriter for the first President George Bush when he debated Ross Perot and Bill Clinton in 1992.
One of the two of them had violated the rules, was going way over their time, and Carol Simpson was not enforcing the rules. George Bush does one of these, basically starts pointing at his watch as a signal to her to please enforce the rules. And the audience doesn't know the rules, and the audience thinks he's looking at his watch because he's got something better to do and he wants to go get a hamburger or something. And it totally backfired on George Bush.
In this instance, George Bush didn't want to be there. He didn't think he needed to prove himself to the voters in that way. And it's interesting, years later, when he was interviewed by Jim Lehrer about that moment, that's what he said. I didn't want to be there.
Whatever doubts were raised by his performance in his first debate with Mondale in 1984, Ronald Reagan had the last laugh about whether he was too old for the job.
And I want you to know that also, I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
Well, I was laughing about it because I thought it was a joke. At the same hand, I think he landed a blow there. It was pretty effective, and between my laughter, there were a few tears coming down there.
Mondale lost to Reagan by a landslide. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia news, a U.S. federal judge has temporarily halted a Trump administration order to ban the popular video app TikTok from U.S. app stores. The ban was due to have gone into effect at the end of the day Sunday. Stay up to date with VOA and see more on VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Republican and Democratic presidential candidates may be dominating the headlines, but they are not the only ones running for U.S. president. What are known as third-party candidates have played a significant role in recent presidential elections. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on whether they could impact the upcoming election.
In the contest for the White House, it is well known that President Donald Trump is running for re-election as a Republican, and running against him is former Vice President Joe Biden, a Democrat. What is less well known is that there are other people running for U.S. president on other party tickets.
The Peace and Freedom Party, the American Independent Party, people really often don't know who these parties are.
People running for smaller parties are called third-party candidates. In the 2020 presidential race, two candidates from better-known third parties include Joe Jorgensen of the Libertarian Party and Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. Another third-party candidate who has made headlines is rapper Kanye West.
The most puzzling campaign, but the one that's gathered the most attention for his party, the Birthday Party. He's often talked about religion openly in his raps, and so he might appeal to more religiously conservative voters.
While third-party candidates are generally not considered serious contenders for the presidency, they can play a role in changing the dynamics of an election. One example is the 2016 race between Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton.
There's no question in 2016 that the third-party candidates hurt Hillary Clinton. All the exit polling showed that the votes that they were casting for third-party candidates were votes that otherwise would have gone to the Democrats.
2016 was a year in which there are a lot of Americans looking at Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton weren't thrilled with either choice, and they cast one of these protest votes.
But experts agree the 2020 election is different.
It's very clear now that the stakes are so high that either Joe Biden or Donald Trump will be the next president, and nobody wants to throw their vote away. And so we're seeing those third-party candidates polling at a lot lower numbers.
Clinton may have lost some votes to third-party candidates in 2016 because of how some Americans viewed her. But Biden does not face the same perception.
Hillary Clinton was seen as a darling of Wall Street and of you know, high finance and these global trade deals that didn't give enough attention to the lives of working class people in blue-collar jobs across America. I think Joseph Biden is from a working-class background from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and I think he can connect with that demographic even if he's associated with some of those trade deals.
The pandemic is also keeping third-party candidates from gaining traction in 2020 because it's tough for them to campaign in person. Third-party candidates also don't have the funds necessary to pay for big TV advertising campaigns.
The absence of third-party candidates that are strong this year should benefit the Democrats.
But as the outcome in 2016 proved, a presidential election can be quite unpredictable. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, has become China's largest trading partner. China-ASEAN trade volume reached $416.5 billion. That's up 3.8% for the first 8 months of 2020. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, social media companies are taking down videos and images that could be vital in prosecuting serious crimes. That's according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter are increasingly using artificial intelligence algorithms to remove material deemed offensive or illegal. Human Rights Watch says vital evidence is being missed or even destroyed. Henry Ridgewell reports.
The Russian missile launcher that prosecutors say was used to fire the weapon that brought down Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 in 2014. The videos were collated from social media sites by the organization Bellingcat, whose evidence was used by the multinational joint investigation team leading the criminal investigation. Russia denies involvement.
What we know from Bellingcat is at some point in the later stages of the investigation, they went back to look at the sources, some of the social media posts that they had used to substantiate their investigations in order to provide that to judicial authorities in the Netherlands. And at that point, the content had come down.
Evidence from social media plays a central role in many investigations, like these videos uncovered by Amnesty International, purportedly showing abuses carried out by the Nigerian army during its offensive against the terror group Boko Haram. In its new report, titled Video Unavailable, Human Rights Watch warns vital evidence is being deleted.
What we started to notice in the last few years, particularly since 2017, is that we would see a video of, let's say, soldiers executing someone or, you know, an ISIS propaganda video. And, you know, if 15 minutes later, an hour later, we went back to look at the video again, it was suddenly gone.
Social media companies told Human Rights Watch they are required by law to remove material that could be offensive or incite terror, violence or hatred. As well as human moderators, many also use artificial intelligence algorithms to take down material.
Nowadays, these algorithms are so effective that they are taking down content the minute it gets posted. So no user ever actually gets to see that content before it comes down.
That includes law enforcement agencies pursuing criminal convictions. The International Criminal Court issued its first arrest warrant in 2017 based largely on evidence collected from social media for the Libyan commander Mahmoud al-Werfali, accused of murdering several captives. Civil society groups like Syria Archive are using social media videos to document potential war crimes, including the use of chemical weapons.
What we're calling for is the creation of some kind of global mechanism, sort of an archive or library.
Human Rights Watch says it is in dialogue with social media companies about creating such an archive. Twitter said it is unable to provide civil society organizations access to users' content without an appropriate legal warrant. Facebook and YouTube had not responded to Human Rights Watch or VOA requests for comment by the time of publication. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia, since the coronavirus pandemic hit the United States, life has changed for most Americans. But the biggest change has been the shutdown of schools and universities. For many young people, the traditional ritual of leaving home to attend college has changed. Karina Befrijian has the story.
The grown children of writer and columnist Mary Dell Harrington are living at home these days. When the pandemic hit, both her son and daughter decided to leave New York and stay with their parents in a large house in Georgia.
You know, we've all gone down the sort of COVID learning curve where we sort of figured out how to coexist. It's made me more appreciative toward my children and the closeness that we have.
For some, moving back in with their parents is a choice, but for the overwhelming majority, it's a pandemic-inspired necessity due to job loss or closed university campuses. According to the Pew Research Center, the number of young Americans living with their parents has grown by over 2.5 million since the start of the pandemic. But experts say the pandemic has just accelerated a trend that was already growing.
And so now that people marry later, they stay in education longer, they have cohabiting relationships that may end after a while, they have jobs that are short-term jobs. It takes longer to get a job that is a long-term job than it used to. And you put all those things together, and it makes sense that more of them would be living with their parents or moving back home with their parents.
23-year-old Yaroslava Zonova moved to the United States from Russia in 2017. She has been living with her parents since then. She says she earns enough to afford her own place, but believes it's easier to get through tough times surrounded by family.
I think that sometimes we stigmatize that living with your parents. I think sometimes we paint with this brush of like that being like a failure. And I really don't think it is, because oftentimes we just, no matter how hard we work, we're victims of our circumstance.
The trend is true among all ethnic groups, and it's hard to tell now whether that will change after the pandemic is finally over. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
Now on VOA Asia, the restaurant industry creates a lot of waste, from food scraps that get tossed away to spoiled produce that doesn't make the cut. But as VOA's Faiza El-Masri reports from Washington, D.C., one chef is determined to make a difference and keep the landfills a little less full.
This is what we always threw away forever. It was rare that you see anybody using it.
My name's Todd Gray. I'm the chef and co-owner of Equinox Restaurant with my wife, Ellen Kassoff. Ellen really was the catalyst for sort of saying, hey, you know, we really need to be a little more careful with the waste that we're doing. We really need to look into composting.
When you're married, you know, as a couple, things can get much more deeply rooted into the philosophy, into the mind of the people running the company than if you were a big corporation. You can't lay in bed at night and have your pillow talk about reducing trash in the restaurant.
The kitchen culture, depending on the training for a chef, they always taught you to never throw anything in the trash.
What we can do at this point is nice little cuts. So if we cut them like this, they're crunchy, but once you saute them, they become soft. All of the mushroom stem, leaves, skins of the onions, shallots that are a little too ripe, celery trim, things that we accumulate over a couple of days. Every morning, this is the next step. We put the vegetables on the fire with water, and there's our vegetable broth.
The Swiss chard stems, which I thought the ideal thing to do would be to take the stems and do something with them. So I said, why don't we tempura fry them and serve them with a simple dipping sauce, some spices and some crystals, some salt crystals. We've trained everyone now that, you know, no food, as we've been cutting, prepping, ends up in the trash. And instead of putting in the trash, we put them in the compost. So we are able to now put our compost buckets in and around the kitchen, anything like that. Goes to the compost, anything that we cook.
It's only 11 o'clock in the morning and we've already filled up, it's heavy, at least 15 pounds.
I provide them with clean buckets. They fill those buckets up with food waste and coffee grounds. I then come and collect those buckets, re-give them fresh new buckets, so they always have a clean supply, and I then compost through hot composting and then feeding that hot compost to worms. And the worms then secrete a manure, which is a very nutrient-rich soil amendment, which then I supply to the farms who supply the restaurants with their produce. So it's a loop-closing cycle, which I'm very proud about and very happy to do.
You can't grow a culture of employees to believe what the owner's vision is unless they experience it and understand it and are educated about it.
That's our program today. We thank you for joining us on VOA Asia. Continue online at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.